Hello everyone, hello football fans around the world. Welcome to the Squawker Talker. We're back. We're talking about Premier League football, obviously, because all the other European leagues are sensible and take a break at this time of year. But British football just hates journalists and hates podcast formats, don't they? Joining me today is Greg Stobart. Hello, Greg.
Hello, Nick. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. How was your festive period?
It was very good. Very busy as well. Lots of football.
Yeah, lots of football. Lots of football. Also joining us is George Ellick. Hello, George.
Hi, Nick.
How are you doing? Happy New Year.
Very good. Happy New Year to you too. And Merry Christmas still. Can we still say that?
Yeah, of course. Of course we can say that. I've got no issue with that.
Good.
Yeah. Okay. Also joining us is Natasha Henry. Hello, Natasha.
Hi, Nick. You're all right.
Yeah, I'm good. Happy New Year.
And to you too.
How are you doing?
I'm okay, actually. I'm glad to be back at work.
Okay, that's good. That's
home was
good.
Boring.
Okay, fair enough. Yeah, same for me. Family arguments left, right and centre. Tempestuous. Let's talk a bit about Sunderland-Liverpool. Stobes, how disappointing is that result for Liverpool? Two goals that they scored. They've done well. They're attacking force again. Give away two silly penalties. Almost gave away a third. They could have lost a third. And it's a 2-2 draw away to Sunderland. Very disappointing.
Yeah, I mean, you hit the nail on the head there. It's one, the manner of defeat, losing a lead. And secondly, the context, because they've just worked so hard to beat Manchester City. And they've opened the door once again for Chelsea. Chelsea basically have a free hit against Tottenham because of that result. You'd never expect Liverpool to draw away Sunderland, who was such a poor team. They got hammered by Burnley at the weekend. And it was just sloppy. I mean, if you look at Mane's handball for the second penalty, it's just stupid. I don't know what they're playing at. I think Klopp could have rotated a few more players, but if you look at their bench, it was so thin, only Origi really to come on. So it's getting to that stage. Game's coming thick and fast. 2 days rest. Coutinho out, Henderson out, Matip out, and they couldn't handle it.
Yeah, George, I mean, a lot of Liverpool fans were talking during the game, during the early stages of the game, of how much Liverpool were missing Jordan Henderson. I mean, he is so pivotal to this side now. He's really emerged as a leader in the middle of the park, and he sort of dictates the play.
Yeah, he absolutely is. And I think he still gets a lot of criticism from opposition fans who are quick to point out that he only passes sideways or this, that and the other, whereas he's actually a really important player for them. They really missed him against Sunderland. I mean, one comment, something slightly positive for Liverpool fans is that in the previous games where they've struggled against worse teams, they've given away a lot of very easy chances. Or actually against Sunderland, this wasn't the case. Except for the two penalties, Sunderland didn't have a shot inside the area that wasn't blocked. They didn't have any other, you know, Mignolet wasn't tested at all. They didn't have any shots off target. They were completely toothless. And it was just, as Greg said, just a silly moment from Mane, which cost him for the second penalty and for the first as well. So there's positives there. I think on the kind of basis of play and the balance of play, they probably deserve to win the game. It was just one of those days where they've given away two silly penalties and that's hurt them.
Yeah, Natasha, Liverpool had twice as many attempts as Sunderland on the day, which is kind of what you'd expect given how attacking Jurgen Klopp is. Moyes was a bit bitter post-match, made an interesting comment. He said, maybe if I was a German manager, you might praise that, talking about the defensive nature of the performance. If I'd been German, you might praise me for doing something different. thoughts on that comment?
I think the problem is, it's the managers that are saying it, why the point's not getting across, but I do think he has a point. When you look at people like Pulis, Moyes, Allardyce, they're so typically British in the way they kind of line their teams up and the way they deal with the media. So people are like, oh, it's just them having another moan in the same way they would if they didn't get a penalty. But there is this kind of, this aura around foreign managers. We're all guilty of it in the media, where the way we talk about how Jose Mourinho makes a substitution and he's tactically astute, and if anyone else does it, then they're boring or they're defensive. So I see where he's coming from, but just take your point, be happy, be glad that you still have Jermaine Defoe and keep praying that you have him in February and get on with it.
Yeah, George, I mean, Moyes, I thought, actually been getting quite a lot of praise this season. He's been doing quite a decent job with an awful Sunderland team.
Yeah, I mean, I think normally when you hear these comments, it irks me. When you hear kind of the likes of Dyche saying this kind of stuff, it annoys me. But I think with Moyes, there's been a very obvious change in tack from him, from his whole career. At Everton, he was always kind of the nice guy. Even at United, you know, he was always very polite. And I think he now knows that he's basically fighting for his managerial career now. Like, if he takes Sunderland down, if he gets sacked, that's him pretty much done at the top level. And we saw in the comments he made about United before the United game, where he came out saying they'd lost their tradition and all this stuff, and he's come out here fighting again. I think it's good. It shows he's you know, he's fighting for his life, he's fighting for Sunderland's life, and they've had a turnaround of fortune since then.
Very interesting. One player that is certainly grabbing the headlines is Jermaine Defoe, Stobes. Another two goals, obviously both penalties, but that now means he's been directly involved in 12 of Sunderland's 18 Premier League goals this term. I mean, where would they be without Jermaine Defoe? An unbelievable signing that they made.
Yeah, he is their attack, I think, in the calendar year 2016.
Yeah.
Only Kane, Costa and Aguero scored more goals than him as well, in a rubbish team as well. I mean, if they lose him in January, as Natasha alluded to, there's a very good chance they'll go down, because it doesn't sound like they've got a lot of money to spend as well. And you look at West Ham and Payet creating chances still, but no one on the end of them. And if West Ham really want him, I think it'd be a perfect signing for West Ham, just some penalty box striker.
He's got unfinished business with West Ham. Like, you watch any interview where he talks about his career and he says he hates the way that he left the club because it was acrimonious. As we all know, he asked for a transfer. So I do think that may be that heart over head where he might be like, let me go back and make the fans love me again. But then at the same point, if he helps keep Sunderland up, he's going to be a hero. And well, it's whether he decides he wants to be a hero in London or the North East, I guess.
I can't see Sunderland letting him go.
They'd be mad to
take too much money than what he's worth.
But imagine the Andy Carroll, Jermaine Defoe, the ultimate big man, little man combo.
Niall Quinn, Kevin Phillips.
Yeah, literally, they're the same level. Duncan Ferguson, James Beattie. West Ham 0, Manchester United 2. Natasha, but we don't often talk specifically about refereeing decisions on the Squawker Talk. We like to go into the tactics, the stats, a bit more analysis. But two decisions arguably killed this game entirely. The Fuguli red card, which is debatable, and the offside goal, the second goal for Ibrahimovic, where three players were offside. The general standard of refereeing over the past couple of months in the Premier League has been disastrous. And once again, it's Mike Dean, who's in the firing line, who seems to be refereeing every big game at the moment and making lots of high-profile mistakes. Or is it just a media narrative?
No, I think one thing I'll give Mike Dean credit for, he's been probably the only ref that stuck to the new rules that they've brought in terms of clamping down on players surrounding the ref or pulling in the box, which I've seen pretty much every other referee ignore after week three. I think the game's getting faster. It's not necessarily that the referees are getting worse. I just don't think they're capable of keeping up with play and making the correct decisions based on one look at something. They need help. And the longer we continue to deny them help, the more abuse, you know, they're going to get, which is what he's getting now. You know, it crosses a line.
Yeah, I'm there with the technology. I mean, I was at the game, albeit about a mile away from the incident.
West Ham.
And my instinct was, he's done him. Because it looked like he'd jumped into a challenge. Jones was rolling around. I mean, Mike Dean was 10 yards away, so should have had a better view. But you can sort that out in 10 seconds with the replay, really. It was a foul and it was a yellow card still, I think. But ridiculous decision, and it ruined the game as well.
Okay, well, the test that they did at the Club World Cup was an unmitigated disaster. But, sorry, Stobes has put his hand up.
Can I just say another thing that is irking me? Gary Neville referred to it as well on Twitter. This whole, you know, celebrity ref Mike Dean makes it all about him kind of thing. That's absolute rubbish as well. I think it's actually quite... The best referees do have a little bit of an ego themselves. Mm-hmm. You think about the best ones, Howard Webb, Kalina, Mark Lattenberg, who is the best in the Premier League, has got a Champions League tattoo on his arm. So, you know...
He's a total diva.
I don't think it's that bad that a referee shows a bit of personality and charisma. Well, it's about the decision.
I think the thing is, what I have an issue... I watched the game at home, so was listening to the commentary. It's all well and good Gary Neville coming out this morning and saying, oh no, the abuse he's getting is horrible and that's unacceptable. He spent 75 minutes ripping Mike Dean to shreds. And whether or not he condones the abuse that Mike Dean's getting now, he has to understand that he is now in the media and he's therefore part of the problem. If he spends the rest of the game going on about Mike Dean as he did, talking about how his head's gone and when I used to be a player, then of course you're going to encourage the fans. They're going to listen to you and they agree with what you say. You know, it's the tribal mentality. So don't moan about him and then moan at other people moaning about him, because you're part of the problem.
No, I think we can moan about the decisions. What I don't like the moaning about is...
No, he was moaning about him.
The funny faces and the mannerisms and all that kind of stuff. That doesn't mean that Mike Dean's trying to take all the attention that he wants to give out red cards and penalties.
I completely agree with Greg. It's not the personality, it's more the inconsistency. If you look at Ross Barkley's tackle on Jordan Henderson...
Same ref.
That's same with Mike Dean, and that was absolutely unbelievable. He didn't give a red card for that, and he was standing for
that.
And
he gave
him a yellow card. And I don't understand how the same person can look at those two tackles and think that one is a red card offence, one of them's
not. The game's too quick for him.
Yeah, he's old. He's one of the older referees.
He's one of the older referees.
What are you trying to say about old people?
He's been around for a while. Speaking of older footballers, outstanding goal by Ibrahimovic, even though he was offside. 18 in 28 now since joining United. But George, it was Rashford who was getting the most praise from United fans. He was absolutely electric down the left. He's been playing very, very well of late, despite getting some pretty harsh criticism early on in the season.
Yeah, I mean, I've written a few. Not nasty, but I've criticised him a bit in the past few months, mainly because I don't think he's a winger, and I've said I don't see what qualities he has for wing play. And then yesterday he proved me very, very wrong. He was really, really good, and it was great to see him come on. I was really surprised it wasn't Martial that came on after his performance a couple of days ago, and I think it was really harsh that he was dropped because he looked back to his best. But it proved to be a masterstroke from Mourinho. That kind of cut in and ball for Mata for the first goal was spectacular. And proper wing play that as well. I mean, he beat two men, he cut back and he chose the right option as well. I still think up front it would be his best position, but at the same time he's young enough and he's got a good enough coaching team around him that they'll be able to kind of forge something out of it. So yeah. Good on him. And it's exciting for United fans and England fans to see him back firing.
A couple more players to mention is actually United are unbeaten this season when Michael Carrick has played and when Marcos Rojo and Phil Jones have played centre-back together to... crucial players in the middle of the park in the middle of defence for Man United. Let's go to Man City versus Burnley. 2-1 win for Man City. Stobes, Guardiola looked absolutely furious in his post-match interview. Any idea why?
I have no idea why. It was so weird and so awkward, wasn't it? I mean, I look at Guardiola and I just wonder if he gets any sleep. Because he's so tired, he's so grumpy, he's so twitchy the whole time. I don't know whether it's a backlash against media reports. You know, he was criticised quite heavily after the Liverpool defeat. I don't know whether he was angry with the red card. He seemed angry with...
Fernandinho.
Yeah, he was angry that free kick wasn't awarded for City because he thought Bravo won the ball. Just very weird. And he's been like that for a while. That interview's been coming. But every press conference, I've been to three or four of his press conferences, and every time he's snapping at the media like anything. And I don't know, he doesn't seem... very happy, does he? And I think the interview actually answered that question. He still didn't seem very happy.
Is it becoming quite obvious now that maybe we can kind of work out why Mourinho and Guardiola don't get on very well because they're very similar?
Yeah,
they are two sides of the same coin, aren't they?
They've got very similar personalities.
No, I can't. They're not similar. For example, Mourinho's Martial must listen to me. I am the boss. That is
sounds like something Guardiola could say.
Yeah, Guardiola does that.
Well, I've not heard him say that, but that kind of bullying, kind of Machiavellian thing that Mourinho has, which we all know I don't like. I think it is very much pick on Pep season. I think everyone expected him to come here. Man City were going to be 15 points clear at the top. They were going to be at the top of their Champions League group. That's not life. That's not reality. It takes anyone time to fit into a new job. And I think... I mean, I don't know why people are so surprised. Have they never watched one of his press conferences before? And secondly, Mourinho's known for moaning about the ref and being rude to journalists. We've seen other managers called journalists fat and they didn't get that much grief. But suddenly Pep does it and it's like, oh my God, he ran over someone's dog. He didn't get a grip. Everyone else does it, but he can't.
To be fair, some people have been saying, George, that Pep's basically, he's had the best head start of any manager to ever come to the Premier League. He had £100 million to spend any way which he chose. He had one of the best squads in the league already. Kevin De Bruyne, Sergio Aguero, you know, an incredible team. He did whatever he wanted and he's not quite living up to those expectations. Is the criticism fair and he's just been a bit of a baby?
I think the criticism is fair. I think what Natasha's saying is right, that it does take time and it was kind of unrealistic to expect him to come in and walk the league. Although they did have that incredible start, unbeaten start as well, where they won however many, 8 or 9 games in a row. But at the same time, they are really performing under expectations. He hasn't come in and made them any better at all. They now look tactically kind of devoid of ideas now, which is so different. I remember that first game of the season against Sunderland, even though they only kind of struggled to a victory, it was still amazing to watch because suddenly these inverted fullbacks, it was kind of fascinating to see how they were playing. Whereas now they've lost their kind of tactical identity. You don't really know how they're going to set up. You don't really know what the game plan is when you watch them. It doesn't seem to be one. And I think the buck has to stop with the manager there. I don't think it's unfair. I don't think it's mean. I think he's not doing his job well enough and he deserves criticism he gets.
Fernandinho, Stobes. Absolute maniac, right? Like, what is he thinking? It's four red cards for City this term. I mean, Guardiola was asked during the aforementioned awkward interview, you know, do City have a discipline problem? Fernandinho certainly does. I mean, what was he thinking? It was a bonkers tackle.
It was ridiculous. We've seen Aguero do it a couple of times as well. Yeah. And Fernandinho, four-match ban as well for their best central midfielder. You can't, you know, we've been talking about the Feghouli tackle, but Fernandinho is a blatant red card. You dive in with 2 feet and your studs up. He must know that's a red card. It's the kind of challenge we talk about every couple of weeks. And he's just an idiot. And City are very lucky that it didn't cost them points.
I think as much as we say Pep had all this money all this time, you can't equate for Fernandinho losing his head every other game. Mm. He couldn't equate for the Yaya Toure situation, which lost him one of their most experienced players for how long. No one expected Bravo to be such a disaster. And then you can't equate for Aguero picking and choosing when he decides he wants to play. Mm. So as much as we can blame him for not making the team better, there are certain things that he can't control.
Well, on tour, though, you can blame him for signing Bravo in the first place or for isolating
Yaya. No one thought Bravo was going to be as bad as he has been.
Yeah, but that means you're taking away the blame for any bad signing.
Yeah. John Stones and Sane haven't been very good either, so we don't blame him for those. That's more than £100 million worth of spending.
Well, John Stones is young. We've discussed this many times. He needs someone experienced alongside him to say, don't do this, that's stupid.
Should have signed someone like that then as well.
Natasha will defend Guardiola more.
No, he's great.
Next week
he's great.
On the Squawker Talker.
No, he's a great manager, like George said. It's just not working at the moment. It's a very tough period. He doesn't have the squad he wants. Certainly, fullbacks and two fullbacks and a centre back, sure. But there is something wrong at City at the moment.
It's not that about defending Pep. I just don't see why he's getting so much vitriol so quickly. When in real life terms, the vitriol he's getting just doesn't equate to the issues he has.
But one last thing on this. They were really bad against Burnley.
They weren't great at all.
Yeah. But they got the result.
I know, isn't that
all that matters?
But he wasn't happy.
Tell Pep that. I don't think it is. I think his reaction to
Natasha mentioned Sergio Aguero. Just a quick point. Our social media director, James McManus, tweeted this yesterday. The goals he scored this season versus Burnley, Mönchengladbach, Middlesbrough, Sunderland, Steaua Bucharest, Stoke, Swansea, West Brom. George, just a flat track bully? I mean, is that an issue? Do you think you're...
Well,
more of the analytics,
I think in their current form, it's important they are scoring against teams like Burnley or they're not going to win. Yeah. But at the same time, I think there's enough. Aguero, over the last 5 years, has basically got himself in the position to score the most goals in Premier League consistently. So it's no fluke that he does it. He still gets himself in the positions over time against good teams as well to score good goals. It's basically, at the moment, partly due to him maybe not being the best form and partly due to City not being in good enough form against good teams as well. In previous seasons against Liverpool, he'd have possibly had a better chance than he actually got in the game. I wouldn't say he is necessarily a flat track bully as a player, but currently that's obviously the case. I wouldn't bet on that lasting much longer. I'm sure he'll get back
more goals, more goals than any other player since joining the Premier League, Sergio Aguero, 113. Let's move a little lower down the table. Stobes, Everton 3, Southampton 0. I mean, it was a pretty predictable result because Southampton played their second game in 3 days. Claude Puel has been rotating his team like crazy this season with the Europa League. But I mean, that fixture planning, whatever you call it, is fixturing a verb? Probably not. It was just completely ridiculous. I mean, it was obvious that Southampton were going to struggle.
Yeah, it was ridiculous. We probably should have mentioned it a little bit more for Liverpool as well, but certainly for Southampton. I can't work out why it wasn't on telly, so I don't understand why they didn't play it today, Tuesday.
Yeah, or tomorrow.
Yeah, it makes no sense whatsoever.
Especially
that,
if
to
Liverpool
me.
Weren't playing at home. Yeah. So that negates the
need for
situation.
The Everton. Yeah,
I really don't understand it, Nick, and you're right, and it's no coincidence that all three goals were conceded in the last 20 minutes when they were absolutely dead. And horrible week for Southampton as well, 3 defeats in a row.
Yeah, quite lucky, Natasha, for Everton to face Southampton at that point. They're now seventh, above the much-lauded West Brom. So, Ronald, maybe they're the best of the rest. We've got that top six. They look pretty settled. Everton, the best of the rest? They don't look very convincing.
I don't know if they're the best of the rest, but I think they've probably got the best players of the rest.
Interesting.
When you look at...
Targeting the manager there.
No, not at all. Not me.
Natasha.
Well, Koeman had been getting, people wanted him sacked last week. So when you look at the individual players, when you look at people like Barkley, Ashley Williams, when he decides he wants to play well, and, you know, Lukaku, then they probably have the players to carry them on further than, say, someone like West Brom, who do need to go out and spend in January if they're going to continue this mad top 10 position.
Mm. And just obviously, as Greg said, it's been a very bad week or kind of 10 days for Southampton. But in terms of who's the best of the rest, they were comfortably kind of looking at it analytically. We had John Byrne Murdoch on our on the Football IQ podcast the other week, who said according to his expected goals model, they were basically clear in seventh. So you've got to wonder, and obviously the loss of Charlie Austin didn't help, but they were creating so many chances which they didn't put away. So you've got to think, have they either lost that form and they're now going to drop down the table, or do they still have the, you know, the ability to maintain that challenge? Is this result just an anomaly because of the fixture schedule? So I wouldn't write them off.
I think he doesn't know who his best team is. I think that's where the problem stems from. Yeah. Even you speak to Southampton fans and they're like, we don't know what our best team is.
You look at Gerald Rodriguez scored twice, he gets dropped for Shane Long. Long comes in, he scores, gets dropped for Gerald Rodriguez.
Shane Long doesn't score.
But they are out of Europe now, so you think they can find some consistency in the second half of the season.
They'll definitely be up there come the end of the season. They'll be looking at a cup run, really, won't they?
Up there. The vaguest term in football punditry.
Up there.
Down there. Middle there.
In the top half of the table, to clarify.
One team that is definitely up there is West Brom. Another win, 3-1 against Hull City. George, Matt Phillips has been one of the revelations of the season. Two assists against Hull. I know it's only Hull, but come on, he's been fantastic.
He's been really good. I think, generally, we've mentioned it a few times. Sorry. We mentioned it a few times. I think that West Brom generally as a unit going forward is so much stronger this year than last year. I don't know if that's because Pulis has managed to get his own squad together, that he feels more comfortable giving them more attacking licence with the likes of Chadley and Phillips now starring. But he's been absolutely superb. And he's probably someone, you know, he's a decent age and is kind of mid-early 20s. So he's someone who could probably make the step up to maybe a better Premier League team.
Yeah, Greg, I mean, West Brom seemed to be terrible at the beginning of the season. Then Tony Pulis signed a new deal. And since then, they've completely turned it around. Has that got anything to do with it? Just coincidence? I don't know. How do these things work?
No idea.
Squawk talker for insights.
They're good though, aren't they?
Yeah, they're good. They're dead good, those West Brom lads.
It does remind me a little bit of that, the way you got Palace going. You know, when at home especially, they were formidable. And it's
that
a little
one
bit
season
like
with
West
Stoke as well, yeah. It feels similar to that.
I think the weirdest thing with West Brom is they have the second worst possession stats. They've got like 43% on average through their games, yet they're sitting in eighth. They've only scored 28 goals. I mean, everyone talks about him being defensive, but if you're defensive and you can score goals, it's going to keep you up.
Yeah.
Look at them now. You know, they're not going to drop too far because there is that big gap down to the relegation zone rather than down there. But yeah, I think he's doing a really good job. I think the fans are no longer on his back, which definitely makes a difference. Yeah,
I'm sure Pulis would be delighted with that 43 possession stat because
he'd be so proud.
Because as soon as they have more, then suddenly they're going to, you know, their best tools like Phillips, like Chadley, who needs space and behind, are going to get blunted effectively. So
yeah, West Brom scored 3 goals despite creating half as many chances as Hull City, which is remarkable. A quick word on Robert Snodgrass, Natasha, directly involved in 9 of Hull's 17 Premier League goals. Just a player that needed a club, wasn't
he? Yeah, just wrap him in bubble wrap.
Bubble wrap up Snodgrass.
Yeah, seriously. He's the only one that you look at and think, on average, is going to create something in every game. It's just about someone being there to take the chances, because obviously he can't score all the time.
Crucial. Middlesbrough 0, Leicester 0 in you know...
the worst Super Sunday game in history.
Not a thriller, but Stobes, Middlesbrough now only 2 points behind Leicester. Are they finally picking up the points their quite solid performances have deserved this season?
Yeah, I mean, I've only really watched them against the top six, and they've been good in all of those games, really. Picked up
just
points.
Losing.
Yeah, well, they picked up points away at Man City and Arsenal, which isn't bad at all. Adama Traore on the counter-attack is exhilarating.
Fascinating.
And the most frustrating player in the Premier League because he can't kick a ball when it comes to the end of the run. But they're a good side, Middlesbrough. They're not too bad. I think they'll be fine. I think they'll stay up.
George, a further word on Adama Traore. He completes 8 take-ons a game on average, but he can't pass, can't shoot, can't... I've never seen a player quite like that. How can you be that good at dribbling and poised and balanced and be so bad at everything else?
Especially when you've come through at Barca. So you'd think you'd have those kind of skills ingrained in you.
Maybe that's why he's not at Barca anymore.
Yeah, exactly. Point, yeah. Well, they actually bought him, didn't they, Villa? I mean, they paid a few quid for him as well, so... I mean, I'd love to pick the brains of his teammates and know what they think about it. I mean, it must be so frustrating to be, you know, Negredo must so often see Adama Traore and thinking, yes, here we go, this is my chance. And then just watch the ball kind of float
to
over his
fair,
head.
To be fair, they've also got Stuart Down in there, so there's someone who knows about being able to run with the ball with little end products.
Oh,
so.
Oh, wow. Natasha.
He's got a nice left foot, Stuart.
Not Stuart.
I think he's
not Stuart Down. How could you?
Is that what you call him?
He's got one of the best left pegs in the league.
I think I'd know if I'd back in a 100 metre race between those two. Yeah.
Imagine. And in the corner taking contest, I think. Yeah. Let's look at the upcoming games. Nearest one upcoming today is Bournemouth versus Arsenal. Natasha, Arsenal desperately need another win to keep up with the frenetic pace of the top four this season. Something that they're used to. Arsene Wenger is definitely used to. Wenger said rotation will continue. Who can we expect to see? Will Giroud start again after scoring the best goal ever? TM.
I think it's more of a Sanchez up front kind of evening. I think Bournemouth like to play like Arsenal, like, you know, ball on the ground, pass, move. So I can kind of see him maybe saying to Giroud, you sit on the bench, because we all know Giroud loves to sit on the bench and then come on and score a worldie. But yeah, he has to rotate, and all Arsenal can keep doing right now is winning. That's all. They don't need to look around them or concentrate on anyone else. Just win your own games. Sounds so simple. Why am I not a football manager?
Yeah, it's just us.
No, literally, keep winning, don't lose. If you have to, draw, and just stay in that top four, because once you drop out, that's when it becomes harder to get back in. I think that's what we're going to see, especially with Man City.
Keep winning, don't lose. George, anything to add?
I mean, it's hard to.
I was at
Stamford Bridge on Boxing Day for the Bournemouth game, and having seen Bournemouth, who are obviously very good on the ball, Jack Wilshere was absolutely brilliant, who's obviously missing for the game because of his loan. I think Arsenal are going to absolutely pummel them because they leave themselves so susceptible to counter-attacks. I mean, I don't know if anyone saw the Chelsea game, but basically Bournemouth control possession, then just Hazard, Willian and Pedro would fly forward. They could have scored 9. I mean, it was just so easy for them to do so. And I think Arsenal at their best this season have been in games where they've let the teams come onto them and they've like flown forward at pace. With the likes of, you know, Sanchez, who said, Ozil, who I don't know if he's back from his illness or not.
I would like to see Iwobi starting the... I said it a few weeks ago in here, actually, that Iwobi as the number 10 could be interesting.
He started in that role against Crystal Palace, actually.
And I think he's so confident and he's so attack-minded. You know, if Ozil's not back, keep him there. Let's see what happens.
On George's point, I was speaking to someone at Bournemouth, and Eddie Howe actually, I think, says that himself. Arsenal is nightmare opponents. Mm. They're the worst. In terms of style of play, it's the worst team to play against.
Imagine that bit might be interesting. If Sanchez starts up front, he has a chance to have the most goals and assists in Europe's top five leagues so far. He's joint leading the pack with 19 alongside Diego Costa and Mauro Icardi. Bournemouth obviously have a 0% result record versus Arsenal. They've just lost every single game. So that backs up what you were saying, Stobes, about Eddie Howe. The big game over the next couple of days is obviously tomorrow, Spurs versus Chelsea. Stobes, everyone except Chelsea fans basically supporting Spurs on Wednesday. Even Arsenal fans will be supporting Spurs. They will
Are
be.
Are they not? They have to be. I think.
Arsenal going for fourth, aren't they? Yeah.
I mean, I genuinely think the title's on the line. Mm. I think this is the key game, potentially, of the whole season. If Chelsea can win it, it's hard to see anyone catching them. They've got Liverpool and Arsenal back to back, end of January, start of February. But other than that, it's hard to see where Chelsea are going to drop points in the coming weeks. The record on the line as well. You know, it's a bit of a cliche, but a night game at White Hart Lane, two teams that don't like each other as well. Mm. The way Spurs are playing, I think they'll give Chelsea a good game. I don't think it's a disaster at all for Chelsea if they get a point at White Hart Lane, especially considering Liverpool drew with Sunderland and City lost at Liverpool. It worked out very nicely for them the whole Christmas period if they can get a draw.
Bit of history, obviously, with what happened at Stamford Bridge last season between these two sides. George, can we expect Pochettino to go three at the back to counter Conte's three at the back? It's going to be...
That worked out well for Everton, didn't it?
Yeah. True.
I wouldn't have thought so. And Bournemouth did the same as well. I think that's been showing up twice now not to really work. Obviously, he's prone to a bit of a tactical surprise at Pochettino, so I'm sure he's got something up his sleeve. But I don't know if the three at the back will be the one. I think the good thing for Spurs is that game against Watford wouldn't have taken much out of them at all. So you'd expect them to be not pretty fresh and kind of ready for the battle. So I agree, it's going to be a fascinating game, one of the games of the season.
Conte was saying after the Stoke game on Saturday, he said Spurs are the best team they've played so far this season, and he included Liverpool in that. Spurs were excellent in the first half at Stamford Bridge.
completely pressed Chelsea so high, and Chelsea couldn't get out of their own half, and Spurs did that with the four at the back. So I'd expect to see the same again.
You have to think with Spurs as well, if they win, that will be such a confident boost for them, because Chelsea has always been one of those teams where they struggle against. And yeah, they were great in the first half, and then Chelsea just switched it on and beat them last time. So it could be, I mean, a draw would suit everyone else fine, I think. But yeah, if Spurs win, it'll be really interesting to see the run they go on after.
We expect a game of few goals, two strong defences, very physical affair as well, it could be.
Yeah, I don't know.
I don't know either.
No, I don't know either.
Anybody know? Anybody?
I think, sorry, Natasha. I think it's potentially one of those crazy games. We're waiting for a really exciting game between the big teams. You think back almost exactly 2 years ago, Tottenham 5, Chelsea 3, just a mental game. I think Spurs are going to fly into Chelsea. Again, I mentioned I was at Chelsea on Saturday, and as well as they've been defending in the last couple of months, the defending for both of Stoke goals was absolutely shocking. And if Harry Kane, Dele Alli and Christian Eriksen are able to find that space and time, then there could be goals in it. And Chelsea on the counter-attack, because Spurs press so high, if you can break the press, Chelsea on the counter-attack can do them as well. So I can see it actually being pretty high scoring.
Very interesting. Another huge game, is Palace versus Swansea. Allardyce calling it the biggest of the season so far for Palace. George, you're actually going to the game, aren't you?
Very, very excited about it too. Yeah, it's going to be great. I mean, it's going to be proper. I think Selhurst Park's one of the best places to go for a night game anyway. It's going to be loud. I think they're going to treat it like a proper, you know, this is the time where Big Sam's going to turn around for them and start lifting them away from that relegation scrap. I think they'll do it pretty comfortably. Swansea are just an absolute car crash of a team at the moment, giving away such easy opportunities to every team they play against and offering very little going forward. So I'd expect a pretty healthy Palace win.
Could be a first clean sheet since the Boxing Day, Boxing Day 2015. Crystal Palace haven't kept a Premier League clean sheet in 20 consecutive games.
Wow.
Alan Pardew. Natasha, since joining, everyone was saying, right, well, Big Sam's joined Crystal Palace. We know what's going to happen now. Christian Benteke is going to be the busiest man in football. He's not used him that much, which is a bit odd, isn't it?
No,
he's not really deployed him, especially against Arsenal. They didn't really hit him that much.
I think he's very much going for the defence first. Let's work from the back and let's stop conceding so many goals. That's, you know, because if you keep a clean sheet, then you can get a point. So I think Big Sam's gone into it thinking, right, let's get the defence sorted, which is really hard considering they have no defenders and everyone's injured. They didn't have one defender on the bench at the weekend. But I think he's really thinking, right, if we can get the defence sorted and then we can work forward. But he is wasting people like Townsend and Sahar, who will be going after tonight's game. You know, they should be getting crosses into Benteke rather than defending, because that's not their strength.
I don't think Benteke is quite as suited to Allardyce as people think. I think Allardyce, he likes a big man, but he likes a battering ram. He likes a Kevin Davis or an Andy Carroll. Benteke is far too casual for Allardyce. He doesn't put himself around. He doesn't. His movement's pretty poor. I don't think he's going to get rid of him or anything like that, but I don't think sort of long balls from the fullbacks up to Benteke certainly isn't going to work. You have to get behind the fullbacks and crosses in.
So strange.
One word on the Arsenal performance, because I like you, was very surprised about how little they looked for Benteke. But in the press conference afterwards, Allardyce was very, very keen to point out to all the press that in his mind, anything from that game is a massive bonus. And they lost
to two kind of free goals.
Yeah,
almost.
Exactly. And the, you know, the key was preparing for Swansea. And I think taking Kabay off after kind of 55 minutes was a sign that his mind was already on tonight. So you'd expect them to maybe go into it with a little bit more gusto tonight than they did on New Year's Day.
One last game to preview is Stoke versus Watford. Stoke's still 15th, but their next six games are obviously Watford, Sunderland, Man United, Everton, West Brom, Palace. So they can definitely start to pick up some points from that, because it's quite tight at the bottom between 9th and sort of 15th. There's only like 4 or 5 points between all of those teams. So, you know, come February, we could be looking at Stoke back in the top half of the table.
Yeah, I think they'll be there or thereabouts, up there, down, right down there.
Speaking of in the middle, up there, down there, Watford are in a similar position. Watford, this is going to sound harsh, but they're a bit of a nothing team this season, aren't they?
They're just really meh.
Meh.
You know when someone says, was that meh, a nice, and you're just like, yeah.
I think they're worse than that.
Worse than meh?
They're young.
Is that nice? And you go, not really, no. I think,
not really, but okay.
I think Matsari's kind of slowly kind of picking apart all the good work that they'd done last year to kind of consolidate their squad as being a good Premier League squad, and they're I mean, if you look at Ighalo, he's an absolute shadow of the player that he was.
And he's still, you can see he's working hard, but there's something missing.
But I feel like Deeney still is performing admirably in a bad team, whereas before he was performing very well in a kind of a more effective team. I think now he's basically having to do it all on his own. I think that they're going to really struggle. It wouldn't surprise me at all to see them, the next club, to really get sucked into that bottom three.
Down there.
I think so. I think Prodl's there only, he's the only player who's impressed me when I've seen him at all this season. Yunus Kabul, awful signing, he's absolutely useless. Against Tottenham, he was...
How does Yunus Kabul keep getting away with it?
Dreadful. He was beyond dreadful.
How does it happen?
And it's always... Well, obviously no top team's going to buy him, but you do think, what are you thinking when you sign this man?
And does it say a lot that he was basically Sunderland's best defender last season as well?
Was, and remember, Maurizio Pochettino, probably the best, arguably the best manager in the Premier League, made him captain of Spurs. Yeah. Well, how much dirt does he have on Premier League managers?
Didn't they have like six captains though that season?
Yeah, true. That was it's a busy one.
Joint captain.
Busy one. Let's move away from the fixtures. And before we finish up, we're going to talk a little bit about the transfers. Obviously, it's January transfer window, everyone's favourite time of year, especially our chief reporter, Greg Stobart, because, you know, he gets so busy, lots of sleepless nights. What's it like working January transfer window in your sort of role? Is it a bit hellish?
January is not usually as bad as the summer, really.
Oh yeah.
Well, certainly for the big clubs. I mean, we've had our pods already, and a lot of it was, well, we're not expecting much to happen unless an opportunity arises. Certainly, the last week of any transfer window is absolutely mental. Yeah. You're just on the phone nonstop, text messages flying, trying to find out what's going on, and a lot of time it's the players who we're going to talk about. It's a lot of time it's the players on the fringes at the big clubs looking to get moves, but not quite as big this year, because often you find in a tournament year, we had the Euros last season or World Cup a couple of years ago, that's when they're really looking for big moves.
I mean, if you haven't heard them, we did a bunch of January transfer pod specials with Stobes, with a bit of analysis looking at who the names might be that are on the move. In the Man United one name that did come up was Morgan Schneiderlin, and there's been activity on that, or at least reported activity. Apparently West Brom and Everton have made a bid. Are you hearing the same thing?
Yeah, 19 million from Everton and West Brom. Man United want 24 million. They basically want their money back.
All right.
That they spent on him. He wants to go to Everton. Based in Cheshire, wants to stay there as well. Work with Ronald Koeman again, of course, who he knows from his days at Southampton. He'll go, and I think he'll go to Everton.
Yeah.
And Mourinho's pretty keen to get him off the wage bill as well, because he earns £120,000 a week.
That's a big... George, do you think... I mean, both of those teams look like a really good fit for Schneiderlin, actually.
Yeah, definitely. I mean... Everton have just given Gareth Barry a new contract, which seems like an odd thing to do if you're about to go and sign Morgan.
He will never die.
Do you know the best thing? I think it's 20-something games away from breaking Ryan Giggs' record.
Unbelievable.
Can you imagine if Gareth Barry becomes the most appearances
in
the Premier League?
I'm up for that. I'm up for that.
But then you also look at Tom Davis, who's their new 18-year-old kind of centre midfield, who started in the Southampton game and looked very good. So... Yeah, I mean, obviously he's a very good signing. He'd improve them, but it seems odd to bring through an 18-year-old centre midfielder and then also sign on a 55-year-old centre midfielder and get a new one. I think West Brom is maybe a better fit. I think he'd be.
I've got a feeling about West Brom. Something about Darren Fletcher and Morgan Schneiderlin just makes sense to me.
I agree.
Yeah,
me and you.
Okay, yeah. Let's go. Yeah. another deal which was supposedly on, which came out of nowhere, was Man United in for Lindelof, which is now off as a deal. Apparently, Greg, is that not happening? Was it ever happening?
It sounds like he's going to sign a new contract, and it may well have been Jose's old mate George Mendes up to a few tricks.
Okay.
I'm sure there were talks about a deal. How keen United actually were in the end, I'm not so sure. Been a while since Mendes actually did a deal with Man United as well. Maybe he's due one as well. But if he signs a nice new contract with a buyout clause and goes in the summer, that would work quite nicely for Mendes and Lindelof. And for Man United, maybe circumstances have changed a little bit. You've got Jones and Rojo playing really well.
It's convenient that the defence improved after the rumours came out, isn't it? It's kind of, you wouldn't be surprised if people were just putting people under pressure.
Yeah, I think he wants to sign a centre-back, but why sign a kid in his early 20s at this stage in January when, at the moment, United can get by until the summer and maybe make a big name signing, or certainly someone who's more experienced and can really lead the defence?
interesting to keep a tab on that. Obviously, the Lindelof contract situation, very complicated with his old Swedish club not being paid by Benfica for the signing and et cetera, et cetera. One player whose situation seems to be rumbling on, Stobes, is Mathieu Debuchy. The right-back is obviously 17th choice at Arsenal currently behind Olivier Giroud. And he claimed in the French media that Wenger doesn't even say hello to him. It's just there's no relationship there.
Hello. Sorry.
Arsenal have been trying to sort of get rid of Debuchy for a while because he's fallen off a cliff since joining from Newcastle. What's the situation there?
He keeps getting injured when they try to sell him.
Yeah.
To be frank,
I think Arsenal fans would just club together to get rid of him. He doesn't even have Diaby's talent that you think, okay, one day they hope he'll get good. He is just... Yeah.
I mean, he's a goner. It'll be a loan deal, I think, because of wages and because who would gamble on a permanent deal for a player who's barely played.
What was it, 15 minutes?
Yeah, by all accounts, he would quite like to go back to a French club, but loads of Premier League clubs looking for a right-back. I mean, I think Carl Jenkinson might well leave on loan as well. You've got Hull, West Ham, Crystal Palace all looking for a right-back. So if someone wants to take a gamble on Debuchy, I think he'd still improve a few sides out there. But as for his future at Arsenal, well, there is none.
Very rare for a player to fall out acrimoniously with Arsene Wenger, especially from a transfer point of view, because he always grants the moves. A more realistic pretty much certain transfer is Rudy Gested to Middlesbrough. Stobes, not the most glamorous move, but one that makes perfect sense. Another target man for Middlesbrough and for Karanka. Another option to Alvaro Negredo, who can maybe pick up some goals.
Yeah, and he's a bit taller than Negredo too, so he might be able to get onto Traore's overhit crosses.
Finally, the game plan.
One transfer that I just want to bring to people's attention they might not know about, especially because I had to write a piece last week about Dream Realistic Wildcard for RB Leipzig. And I did the Squawker suggest Scott Hogan. So to my massive surprise last night, looking at my phone and seeing that RB Leipzig are being linked to a £15 million move for Brentford striker Scott Hogan, which would be fascinating for an English point
ludicrous.
Of view.
Ludicrous.
I mean, it'd be incredible. I mean, he's scoring. His goal per minute ratio is like phenomenal. He basically was injured for the best part of 2 years when he first moved to Brentford from Walsall. Might have to cut that out.
Rochdale.
From so he signed to, and then he came back in the last season, scored lots of goals. This season he's been scoring at a massive rate. And to have a kind of a young, he's only 24 years old, a young English striker, kind of starting up front for a top Bundesliga team, I'd be fascinated to watch it alongside Oliver Burke.
Burke doing over there?
He's
not really playing.
He isn't
player,
playing
isn't
anymore,
he?
Really. Yeah. He's not really featuring, but he's very young. I think that basically because the stakes have got a bit higher for Leipzig, playing him to kind of improve his development isn't the key issue at the moment.
Scott Hogan would perfectly fit RB Leipzig's sort of player recruitment strategy. On the more ridiculous scale, end of the scale, Natasha, in terms of transfers, there's a rumour going around that Miralem Pjanic, who's recently signed for Juventus, is going to Arsenal. Thoughts?
Oh, every summer, every transfer window, there's... He's going to be the name that's now linked with Arsenal for the next 4 years until he's 35, and then they'll actually put a bid in because they would have spent enough time researching him and watching him. There's always
or they'll
someone.
Get Kim Charlstrom instead.
or he'll go to City, probably.
Yeah.
They'll scout him, City will buy him.
The real rumour that's getting traction is Dele Alli to Real Madrid for £50 million. Stobes, is there any credence to this rumour at all?
In January?
Yes.
Absolutely not.
In the summer, though?
Lol.
Lol.
Yeah, I don't think it's impossible one day. We know Dele Alli's very ambitious, and Real Madrid have been watching a lot of Tottenham. They were watching Harry Kane, that's a 100% for sure. So if they've been watching Harry Kane, they've been watching Dele Alli, and you know, such a bright player, goal scorer as well. And it's up to Tottenham really to match his ambition, and I think he'll stay for another year or two, and he should do for his development. But if in 18 months time Spurs aren't developing, maybe they're not in the Champions League, he'll have his pick. He could choose Man United, Man City, and I think Real Madrid and Bayern Munich should be in for him too.
James Rodriguez out, Dele Alli in. That's all we've got time for on the Squawker Talker this week. Thank you very much to Mr. Greg Stobart, Mr. George Ellick, and Ms. Miss Natasha Henry, for joining me today. George Ellick will be back on Wednesday. You've got an interview with Dan Bond from Oxford.
Yeah, he's
the
performance analyst at Oxford United. So speaking about kind of two things. Firstly, how his role in preparing players for matches and how he looks at opposition teams and how he sets up and goes to the manager, his relationship with the coaching staff and how they set up the team to play against them. And then also a bit on recruitment, because it's a January transfer window, and how teams in the Football League look at players and how they scout them and what they're looking for in players. So please tune in.
Fantastic. Yes, please do tune into that. And don't forget to listen back to Rory Briggs's one-on-one he did with Nicole Holliday, and also all of our transfer pods that we've been doing over the Christmas period. Thanks very much for listening. Please subscribe on iTunes, follow us on Twitter, and we'll see you very, very soon.